Hello and welcome to the Hash Rugby Chat podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so that we can drop into your phone every week. If you'd like to watch what happens behind the covers, then the show's live on YouTube as well at 8 p.m. New Zealand time every Tuesday. You can also join in the discussion on our five questions via Twitter. Just follow at Driving Maul on Twitter. Look out for the questions and use Hash Rugby Chat. I'm Paul, the guy behind Driving Maul. And I'll be your host for the next hour or so. And I am delighted to have with me two, I wouldn't call them regular guests anymore. I just call them part of my team. So we have Will from Rugby Numbers. How are you doing this evening, sir?
Yes, very good, Paul. It's good to be back. I'm glad that I've obviously done something right, because you keep having me on.
Well, as you just told us, you have gin and tonic on tap, which is great. And from Real Michael Pullman. Sorry, Real Mike Pullman, get it right around. We have Mike down in Hamilton. How are you doing, sir?
Good, mate. It's great to be here. No gin and tonic for me. Not even a cup of tea.
Oh dear. Well, I'm on the cider homebrew. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll have seen the photo earlier. This is a refill. Don't worry, it's not the same glass from 2 hours ago. So anyway, this evening we'll be talking about Super Rugby, the laws of the game, sevens, and the Rugby World Cup. So let's crack right on into it. Question number one. Was there any disadvantage for the Lions going to that last weekend having not faced New Zealand sides in the regular competition? Who wants to kick us off?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, like, I've changed my mind in the last few days, actually. I sort of thought that, you know, they weren't going to beat the Hurricanes, and that was purely based on probably a bit of arrogance, to be fair. And, they didn't only beat the Hurricanes. I thought they played a lot better than them for the most part. So, I don't think they were at a disadvantage.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, some of the Hurricanes' performance, especially in the second half, you could probably put down to travel and altitude and all the normal excuses. But the Lions certainly won much more convincingly than those factors could account for on their own. I mean, sure, there's probably something to be said for having some tough matches during the regular season, but it doesn't take away from the fact that they are a strong quality side. They were finalists last time, and then they beat the defending champions in their semi-final. So I don't think you can say it's really cost them much at all.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's something we've seen a lot in our press over here in New Zealand. But as I think Mike has pointed out, I think it's been an arrogance from the media around this, around not having faced New Zealand opposition. And I think they were perfectly up to speed going into that game. It wasn't a problem at all for them. Let's talk about what they did well last weekend. For me, one of the big things was I thought they managed to change their game plan on the pitch, on the fly. They started initially trying to match the Hurricanes by playing some wide, expansive, fancy stuff. Perhaps not as wide or as fancy as the Hurricanes, but still trying to get it out amongst the backs. But to me, they switched it up to a bit more of a pick and go, kept it tighter, and took the battle to them up front to suck in some of the defenders. I thought it was good to see that leadership on the park.
Yeah, they definitely changed up the game plan, and, you know, I think it was, 22-3 down that they were, and in that situation you have to change the game plan, and they played such a positive brand of football in that second half, and I think when that happens, a lot of things actually go your way, and you know, a lot of people in the media have talked a bit about the ref, and we have too, but the Lions deserved that victory, and because of the belief that they played with and the positivity. I mean, it's when you're looking at that kind of deficit, you know, you're down and out, really, and you can even just go home and play the game, and that's what they did, and they won.
Yeah, I think you touched on something quite important there, Michael, which is that they have real character, that team. You know, you can see it in their attitude, the way they sort of conduct themselves and the way that they give their sort of post-game interviews and things. They've got a really sort of positive attitude. They just don't give up at all. They seem to have this relentless belief that they can succeed. And it just pays off for them. And, just to make the point again, as a Hurricanes fan watching the match, I was getting pretty frustrated with some of the calls, you know, and I felt felt that perhaps their first try hadn't been grounded. I felt that Barrett's yellow card was particularly harsh. And I was getting all wound up about it. But then when I sort of went back and reviewed the match afterwards, it still wasn't the difference in the match. Even allowing for all those factors, the Lions were just clearly the better team. And even without those, they still would have won, I think.
I think so. I think what's actually interesting, one of the comments we've got on YouTube here from Anton May saying they had the same from the SAF newspapers. So it sounds like it wasn't just the New Zealand press that was talking about the strength of opposition, but it also over in South Africa as well, which is kind of interesting to hear it from that side of the of it as well. The Hurricanes, they say, were outplayed. And apart from sort of tiring in the second half, I thought they actually did play a decent game. It wasn't like we had sort of bad play actually from any of the four sides during the semi-finals, which was good to see.
I think with the Lions as well, I mean, I wrote about it today and I sort of touched on it, like South African rugby, it's in a bit of an interesting place at the moment. You know, the national team is not really doing as well as they would like. And I know we're talking about Super Rugby, but the game over there really needs success. And I think... I think the Lions just that mindset at halftime. It would have been, look, we're not going to go down like this, and it's actually, when you think about, bloody good story, you know,
and I think I just sort of to basically repeat what I said before. You know, this is a team that has historically been pretty awful, you know, and I've written about that on my site in the past. And their turnaround is almost unprecedented. The rate at which they've started winning over the last couple of seasons is really unmatched by any other team in Super Rugby. And if anything, the rate at which they're winning matches has actually accelerated this season as well. And you've got to get something out of that. And a home final is what they've got for it.
Absolutely. There's a couple of comments in there discussing the live chat on YouTube, discussing the strength of the... of the format, and quite rightly, as Josh says, Lions have been in finals for a couple of years, so obviously worthy. We totally agree with that one entirely. But I think a lot of people are saying, yeah, they'd like to go back to a round robin format, and that kind of talk about the format once we actually have it finalized, because at the moment we still don't know if Australia will be managed to cut a team. But I think one of the things we've got to notice, got to realize, is that if we're going to have a competition that is large enough to compete with the Europe financially, then we can't have round robins and still have players stay because just the amount of travel is just going to kill them, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And just the sheer amount of matches. I mean, we're talking about, let's say, 18 teams or thereabouts. If every team plays every other team home and away, you're looking at kind of 300 matches in the season. It's just completely unworkable. And even if you halve that down to each team plays every other team once only with some sort of alternating home and away between seasons or something, you're still talking at sort of 150 matches, which is sort of 25, 30 more than what they currently do. And it already feels like there are enough. So I certainly understand this sort of argument in favour of a round robin. It's certainly the only truly fair way to determine who's the best team. But it's just completely impractical for a competition of this size.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, if the Crusaders get up and win this weekend, there's going to be a lot of people, a lot of arrogance again. But something needs to be done about the structure of this competition. And I mean, I don't think, like, the Lions should have to play every Kiwi side to convince us that they're capable. But I think at least, you know, one team. But you see in the weekend just now, we've seen that one game and they've proven us all wrong. So I don't think it's an easy fix, but definitely need to do something about the structure.
Yeah, it goes both ways, right? All these people saying that for a title to be valid, then they need to beat all the Kiwi sides. You've got to go the other way and say, well, then all the Kiwi sides have to play every other team as well. And then we get people whinging about the low quality one-sided matches between the strong teams and the weak teams. So you sort of can't have both.
Now, we should. It's a good point about the if the Crusaders get up. So we should probably move on to That's great. Move on to our second question. What do we see from the Crusaders against the Chiefs that gives them belief going to the Super Rugby final this coming weekend? Because the Lions have the home advantage. They haven't had to travel. They don't have the altitude. I think 2000 was the only time that an overseas team has won won a final. That was the Crusaders in Canberra, which is definitely nowhere near as far to travel as across to South Africa. So with all of those things against them, what do we see at the weekend that gives the Crusaders hope?
Well, I think one thing that I saw someone pointed out, I think on Twitter, was that there may have only been one team that's had to travel to South Africa for a final in the past and win, but there have been plenty of teams that have travelled that same distance and won knockout matches. So it's not entirely unprecedented that teams can win after that amount of travel. So I don't know if it's quite as big a factor as it's kind of made out to be.
I think with the Crusaders, they showed against the Chiefs that they get into that red zone, they score points, and not just penalties, they're getting tries. And if that will give them the belief, I don't think the travel is going to be a factor at all. They were so clinical in that semi-final. Like I said, getting the tries when they got down into that 22. And if they can do as well as that in Johannesburg, I think they'll win it.
So so you're looking at the clinicalness at finishing is what you think has been their big strength over the last couple of games?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's actually been a strength all year, as well as the defence, And when you have a forward pack like they do, then you're going to have a remarkable defence. So yeah, but they're just so ruthless, Once they get in that 22, they're getting the 5 points, and that's what it's going to take to win the final, not penalties.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? And I mean, that's sort of what has always characterised the Crusaders, is this kind of, like you say, just ruthless edge. And, it's amazing how often they win compared to other teams. Historically, they've won far more matches than the other team. It's just they stopped winning grand finals in recent years. But, and then arguably, some would say 2014, they probably could have won that one as well. But I think, it's a lot over here is made of the fact that they effectively have the All Blacks forwards, and I think that's a genuine point. They are a very, very strong team up front, and especially in South Africa, that's going to give them, a solid platform to start with.
Yeah, I guess so, especially that type five, because that's pretty much the Chiefs. If you look at their back row of Sam Kane, Leach, Messam, you've got all three class internationals. Bodie Retallick in the second row is a World Rugby Player of the Year. So it's hardly like the Chiefs pack lacked that kind of thing, that kind of experience or power. But the front row was isn't quite up to it. Whereas you look at the Crusaders, especially that front five, it's all Blacks, isn't it? Pretty, I think from memory. And then obviously Kieran Reid, Todd, also All Blacks as well. So I think that's where it's going to have to be won, and their defence. I think one of the things we saw with the Lions is, I say, they switched that pick and go, because the Chiefs were fanning out. Sorry, it was because the Hurricanes were fanning out across pitch on defence and not committing to the breakdown. And we're seeing that that to me was how the Crusaders defended against the Chiefs as well. So I think we're going to have to. It is going to be that pick and go. It's going to be a bit like the All Blacks' first test against the Lions. It's going to be a monumental battle between those front eights.
Yep. And it works.
Not so much.
It works, so why change it? All season, the Crusaders have looked rock solid. They had a slight wobble after the break, and during the break, in fact. They obviously had a fairly catastrophic loss, but why change a winning formula? It doesn't have to be that complicated.
I think composure as well, this team and the differences that I see between the forward pack in comparison to the Chiefs, with the exception of Brodie Retallick, I think the Crusaders have slightly more leadership in that forward pack. But the whole team, this Crusaders side, if anything this year, they've just been composed in situations where probably all the other teams in this comp would have been in a losing situation, and we saw that particularly against the games against the Highlanders in the round robin. You know, they were out of those games, and then yeah.
Just a comment on Twitter from Graham Macken. He says they dominated their conference again. Talking about the Crusaders, would have been interesting to have seen them in New Zealand. So with the home field advantage in New Zealand. Do you think that would have swung, things in their favour? If they had been at home, they'd almost be... I can't see anyone considering the Lions to be favourites in that scenario.
I think after what we saw last year in the final Wellingford, no, they wouldn't have been. I think, yeah, the Crusaders at home would have been favourites. Both these teams have won all their home games. And both teams only lost one game all season, to be fair. But they've all... I think it was 9 from 9 at home. The Lions' only loss was away to the Jaguares, funnily enough, in Argentina, where they took a weakened side. Some resting of players, but also other issues as well. You know, some injuries, some family issues that meant some of the other players didn't travel. So, and then the Crusaders' loss was obviously that last one against the Hurricanes up in Wellington. So, having a perfect home record, you've got to say that the home side has got to be. Has got to be favourite from whichever way it was going to fall.
Yeah, I guess, you know, if the tables were turned and the final was in Christchurch, getting back to the competition, it'd be nice for the Lions to have had at least one trip over here and played one game in New Zealand. And regardless of if they had have lost, they could have said, well, hey, we've done it, we can come back and have another go. But I guess that's all sort of irrelevant now.
And yeah, that point you made earlier, Will, about crossing the ocean. My rugby post on Twitter has gone and said, yeah, Chiefs crossed the Indian Ocean to win two playoffs. Crusaders can learn from them and achieve the same feat. So we'll see about that, whether they can pull it off. But there's also other comments around the on YouTube around the lack of possession they had, which comes back to, Mike, your comment about how clinical they've been during these last couple of games. And how they have confidence in their defence. One of the things I thought about putting in a question that I didn't actually do, but with the Crusaders doing so well, with Saracens up in Europe also relying on a defensive structure that they're happy to absorb and give the ball away, do you think we're moving perhaps... the last Rugby World Cup was about attack. Are we sort of... all these cycles of things, are we moving into a period where defence is going to become the predominant factor rather than attack for a while over the next couple of years?
I think there's definitely something to be said for it. You look at other sports like soccer and NFL, and defence certainly, I would say, is the difference between the good teams in those sports. And I think you see that again, becoming especially obvious in Super Rugby, where when you've got two teams that are very similar in kind of strength or have very similar kind of records and playing styles, defence, I think, is what wins it most of the time. And I think, you know, we've seen it at the international level as well. And you can see it when the Hurricanes are a good example, because they got a new defensive coach a couple of seasons ago and they just stopped conceding points remarkably quickly. They just tightened right up, and that was what took them to the finals. You know, I don't think they're... attacking style really changed, and I don't think they really gained new skills or anything like this. What I saw was that their defence tightened up, and that's what took them there.
I think it's horses for courses, really. It's quite hard to see, because teams around New Zealand, I mean, they are a lot different in the way they operate, and Chiefs have a very expansive sort of outlandish game plan that they'll be prepared to run from inside their own 5-meter line, whereas Crusaders not so much. So it's quite a hard one to answer, really.
Oh, we'll see which one comes on top. It was just one of those things, thoughts that occurred to me the other day. I thought I might have just throw it out there. One of these other things people have said is last year's finals was the Lions' first foray into the big stage. And there is definitely a history, mainly in European rugby, where you make it to the finals and lose, or you learn to make it to the semi-finals, you then learn to make it to a final, you then learn to actually win a final. It's very rare to see a team go from sort of not even making the playoffs to suddenly being a champion. And that's where the Lions have got that, gained that experience, whereas the Crusaders, perhaps it's a bit of an old, well, they used to have that experience, but the current crop, much less so. And with that, I think we'll moving on to our third question. And in light of Sonny Bill Williams' ban and New Zealand rugby appealing against the games that have been chosen for that count towards it, we've seen in the past that Hooper has used a club game to get over a ban. So which games should be included for bans?
International games.
Well, what is the sorry, Paul? What is the actual current ruling? Because you occasionally see some number of weeks dished out as a ban, and sometimes you see some number of matches dished out as a ban. I'm not quite clear what the ruling is.
So basically, the bans are given out in weeks, and so they'll say 4 weeks. But what they really mean is 4 sort of weeks of games. So it means 4 games in effect, rather than actually weeks. Even though weeks is a terminology that's kind of used, and the other term that gets put in there, I'm trying to make sure whether I get the right word here or not, but I think the word is significant games only count. So that's been, and that's what the word significant is open to all sorts of interpretations, which is what has led to this ambiguity and different decisions that have been made in the past, and it's not been clear. Now I've got some sympathy with the lawmakers on this one. The laws aren't made for professional rugby. The laws are made for rugby, whatever level you're playing at. So how do you say for someone who's playing, and the Australians call it subbies, or someone who's playing third string club rugby, how do you define which games they should or shouldn't lose when in comparison to, or should or shouldn't be able to play in comparison to senior professional rugby and at the top there?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. It's a judiciary that enforces laws, right? So there has to be some interpretation and a judgment has to be made. And I think I'd agree. I have some sympathy. They have to make a call somewhere which games are going to count towards the ban. I think the thing that probably frustrates fans is the same thing that frustrates fans about refereeing. It's that there appears to be inconsistency, right? There have been cases in the past where seemingly insignificant matches that the players probably weren't even going to play have counted towards bans. And then you see something like Sonny Bill recently where he's been told, no, those don't count and you will be missing at least one international.
Well, so let's just quickly just run through. I mean, this, and again, the question is more about general than Sonny Bill, but we're just using Sonny Bill as an example. He missed he had a ban for 4 weeks or 4 games. So obviously he missed the Lions' third test. He missed the Blues game against the Sunwolves, which makes sense. And then we have a whole bunch of games that have been submitted as being possible. So those include a county's inter-club hit-out as a pre-season. That included a sort of All Blacks versus two Mice 10 Cup sides over 3 halves of in a game. They got to include the counties versus North Harbour pre-season warm-up game, and then the last one was going to be the Bledisloe Cup, but I say as it's under, or the Bledisloe Cup warm, it's under appeal.
I need to say something because I'm tweeting it right now. I don't understand this. All right. You get a ban playing for the All Blacks, as far as I'm concerned, should be a ban for the team of which you were serving when you were playing. Now, it's really, to me, it's really, really bad that Steve Hansen and the New Zealand Rugby Union and whoever else want to make a big issue of this, try and get him into that counties match. Look, you've got so much depth in the midfield. I don't care what anyone says. Ned Brown, Cotty, you know, a lot of guys in there. Let's just leave it be. If it wasn't Sonny Bill, we would not be having this discussion right now. At least the New Zealand media wouldn't be.
That's very true. And I have tweeted in the past about games where I don't think it's right. Personally, I don't think the counties versus North Harbour game should count because it's a game he wouldn't have played. He's not getting punished by missing that game. It's a preseason game. It's not a competitive. It's not a tournament game. And as we've seen, that New Zealand rugby are now changing that three halves game to two halves to make it fall in proper rules to try and make it look like a real game. Clearly, these are games that can be arranged to get rid of bans, and therefore they shouldn't be included in my book.
I think the issue, sorry Mike, you go ahead,
let's be honest, I mean, when else would you see Sonny Bill turn up at whatever stadium that is in Pukekohe? You wouldn't see it happen.
Yeah, I think the issue is it's if you say that the ban's going to apply to matches at the level where the offence occurred, it's not hard to come up with some sort of fringe cases where, you know, perhaps it's the last match of the season and the player gets to carry on with their Super Rugby career and then has to sit out the first four matches of the next international tour or something. So, or, you know, it might be a case where the player isn't going to play anytime soon. You know, and so I think it's hard to come up with a blanket rule that applies to all levels of the match, all levels of the sport, that's not going to throw up some sort of awkward exceptions. And so it makes more sense to have a judicial process where each case is treated, you know, within some guidelines and a hopefully sensible ban is applied. But I think the hopefully sensible is the contentious part, right? It seems like, I would agree, Sonny Bill in this particular case, there's another major international tournament about to start after the Lions tour. He should miss four of those matches.
I just want to say one more thing as well. I'm sorry for getting so heated, but when Sonny Bill first got that red card, Hanson walked into the press conference and said, look, I don't want to talk about it. It's happened. We have to move on. Now he suddenly wants to talk about it. Hypocrisy that no one will call him out on. And is it any wonder
I know you got me, but you're about to go on. Is it any wonder why we're all had enough with mainstream media perhaps why the All Blacks doesn't quite have the standing it used to have in society? And those are topics we should probably cover on another day. But to me, I think we're getting to the stage where we might need a different set of rule or a set of laws for the professional game versus the amateur game, and actually clearly define it. In Europe, it's easy, to be honest with you, because players play for their club and they play for their country, and that's it. There's no other levels that the players play for. It's only the Southern Hemisphere where we have a problem, and the problem is the players are registered for a club, they're registered for their province, they're registered for their Super Rugby side, and they're registered for the international team. So they have four levels of rugby, two of which the top players don't really play in. And if you're in those bottom two levels, you're not going to make that top level. So whilst there are four levels, you kind of only play normally in two, occasionally in three if you're going to come back from injury. But that's where the complication comes from. Whilst I like the idea of it only applying to that level, my problem with that one is is where it's something like eye gouging. If someone gets a 6-month ban for eye gouging from international rugby, they definitely should not be allowed to be playing club rugby or Super Rugby beneath that. So that should be a blanket. So I don't. This idea of only having it at that level, I don't think can work because of the for real dirty play and dangerous play. But I do think we should probably say if you get a ban at international level, the only games that count towards it are international and the level below. So whether it be that club rugby in Europe or Super Rugby in the South, if you get a ban at Super Rugby, games that can count towards it are Super Rugby, international, and Mitre 10 Cup. And that's. Yeah. And that way, you kind of there's some sort of bracketing without it pulling in shoot field games, as we saw in Hooper's situation.
I mean, I agree that, Paul, that sounds sensible. I think the problem is when you take into account how many levels of rugby there are around the world, having it consistent globally is probably going to be a nightmare, right? If you have to go through and define for each possible scenario of sort of clubs and international sides that a player might be in. Which is why I think we probably have the system that we currently have, which is...
I'd say we should keep the current system for non-Tier 1 competitions. And the professional level, which is in the shop window, which can give the game a bad name, is much more clearly defined, so we don't have these ambiguous, silly things going on. And I think this is where we might be starting to see a parting of laws for the top-tier professional game and for the rest.
Sure. Quite an interesting comment from Hugh Rothwell on Twitter. He says, could a waiting type system work? So I'm not quite sure what he's getting at by that, but perhaps he's suggesting that each match, you know, like missing one international is the equivalent of missing two Super Rugby matches or something like this, and you just sort of add them all up over until you've got a satisfactory ban. I might have misunderstood what he's saying, but there's some merit in that idea.
That's a really interesting concept, and we'd need him actually on here to kind of flesh that out properly. But yeah, that's a kind of interesting one. Super Rugby games are worth half, or my 10 cup weight games are worth half. Sorry, I'm just tweeting him back now. I think we all agree that there's been some hypocrisy around here, and that it should only be proper, meaningful games. And that it is ambiguous. Now, whether we go through the judiciary or whether we go through clearer guidelines is open for discussion.
Probably one other comment just to throw in before we move on, Paul, which is that bans aren't necessarily the only type of punishment, right? You could impose fines or various other things as well. So it'd be interesting to hear what our viewers and listeners have in the way of ideas for alternative forms of punishment that might work around this issue.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, mate, because you see a lot in cricket, you know, players get fined half their match fee or something, and whereas New Zealand Rugby in particular, it just seems like, hey, it's a ban, you know. There needs to be some individuality in this conversation, and I mean, I know I've just said, hey, you do this for the All Blacks, it should be for the All Blacks, but I think horses for courses situation, and yeah, tough one.
It is. So moving on, question number four. The New Zealand Sevens didn't make any finals last season. What do they need to regain their former glories? Just to give some people an idea as to what I mean by former glories, New Zealand have won 12 out of the 18 Sevens World Tours. Fourth is their worst ever position, which they've done three times now. What does New Zealand Rugby need to do to get their Sevens back up and running?
This is purely an assumption on my part, but I think that it's a bit of an identity problem with Sevens in New Zealand at the moment. The lack of interest in the Wellington Sevens hasn't helped. And I think since the departure of Titchens, but maybe even before that, there were some issues, and maybe it's higher up than the actual team. I actually don't know, to be honest, like what they can do. I think the struggles are gonna continue well longer than this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just as an aside,
okay. Well, I think we just lost you there. So let's see if he comes back. Well, I mean, I guess one of the things is that New Zealand Sevens has always been used as a development pathway for the 15s. So you've had players like Lomu, Cullen, etc., historically play in Sevens, which we've not seen it used that way, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. And Australia, I think, have used it a little bit that way as well in the past. What has happened is that players or clubs, teams like England, have become fully professional at the Sevens level, which we haven't seen New Zealand take the same approach. It was interesting reading a Scott Waldrum interview. He was the interim coach for the New Zealand Sevens and is now being jettisoned. But one of his comments was, we're calling up club rugby players when we've had injuries, whereas you see that the European and other sides are pulling up players who are training at full-time professionally already for injury situations. So it looks like, I think, basically New Zealand has been passed in the professionalisation of Sevens in the recent years.
Yeah, I think, like you mentioned, you know, like other nations have got much more investment and much more professionalism, really, in the Sevens arena. But I think the mistake that New Zealand made heading into Rio was the... and this is not a shot at Sonny Bill or Liam Messam or any of them, but I think it just caused a big distraction. And the All Black Sevens were a better team when they had, you know, specialists, if you like. And I think we're probably going to get back to that point, but yeah.
Yeah, I think we are heading towards back towards specialists, with the exception of some players like Rico Iwani and his brother, who are coming through as development, who will play it for a couple of years and then go on to the 15s. But I do think we need more of the DJ Forbes style people who concentrate on it full time, and that is their career for New Zealand Sevens to get back there. As you say, it does have an identity crisis as to where it sits, and it sits differently to a lot of other countries. But what's interesting here is that there is, to me, there's a much more defined Sevens, what's the word I'm looking for here, season than in the UK. Whereas in the UK, the professional sides won't play, they literally play one Sevens tournament, which is the Aviva Premiership teams put in a Sevens team, which quite often is mainly their academy players. And it's a pre-season series where they play one tournament, society makes the finals, and then the following weekend they have the finals. Whereas here in New Zealand, there's actually a set season, and we do have Auckland, Wellington, and the sort of provincial sides meeting up and playing top level sevens.
Yeah, and I was reading a thing in the Hill today. I know you don't read the New Zealand media, but the New Zealand women's rugby team preparing for the World Cup, and they're talking about sevens. You know, and I think, like they're sort of saying, we want 15s and sevens to both have a place in the women's game in New Zealand. But that's the thing. I think that place, that sense, like we said, the identity is, it's not lost, but it's in a state of confusion at the moment, I think.
It is, and Richie Palmer on Twitter makes a good point. Take the All Blacks out of their name and get the New Zealand public interest in sevens again. It's the New Zealand sevens. It's not another branch of the All Blacks. This is what you're saying. Rugby New Zealand is trying to piggyback off the All Black brand from a financial point of view. It's perhaps they've missed a trick here, and actually by trying to merge in rather than giving its own identity, that has been a problem. That's a very good point as well. On to our final question, which is, should the World Cup expand to 24 teams?
Remember the conversation we had a few weeks ago about, like, given the fact that the World Cup is in Japan next time, it's a really good opportunity to break into some new markets. I can see the benefits of it, but I can also see, like, you know, all the one-sided games. I don't know if I want to see a World Cup where there's, like, you know, we already see enough one-sided competition at these tournaments. And, yeah, I don't think so.
I guess there is talk of, obviously, the tier two countries, look at Georgia, Japan in the last Rugby World Cup, had closed the gap. We weren't having those big scores that we saw previously, where I think the All Blacks put up 100 points on Japan. Japan beat South Africa. Now, fine, I'm not trying to compare the South Africa to the All Blacks of about 8 years before that, but they definitely make leaps and bounds to close that gap. So I think part of this is about trying to spread the game, because we don't really want it just to be the same 12 countries that it's in now. We do want to look at other, to have it as being more of a global game. And how do you include those if you don't give them a chance at the Rugby World Cup?
Yeah, I guess you raise a really good point, you know, because to be able to, they have closed the gap, these nations, but to be able to beat the best, or at least compete with the best, you got to play them. And I think that, like, the Pacifica Challenge, for example, it should become a yearly thing. And that will only do Samoa best good. The thing is, like, I remember the Pacific Nations Cup, I don't follow it anymore, but I remember when it first started, you had like the Junior All Blacks in there, and the competition seemed a lot, more, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
To me, one of the things I've suggested in the past that we should do with the Psychologists, Will, good to have you back on the show again. One of the things that we talked about, that I've suggested in the past, is that actually the Wallabies, the New Zealand Maori, the Maori All Blacks, as they're now called, the All Blacks should all play a pre-season or the Rugby Championship season game in the islands. So as a warm-up game, New Zealand would go to Fiji, Australia would go to Samoa, and the Maori would go to Tonga, for example. And then the following year, they would rotate so that New Zealand were in Tonga, Australia were in Fiji, and the Maori were in Samoa. And that would do a number of things. One, it would give them, those countries a home international against a tier one team that they knew they were going to get every year and that they could plan around. Currently, they can't plan around having any tier one games. They can't put the commercial structures in place where they meet up or where they sort of so they can sell the corporate tickets. They don't get that regular income from a big game to put into either coaching or stadiums to build bigger stadiums so they can house and get more money from these games. So I know a lot of people said, "Oh, look, when the All Blacks went to Samoa, they lost $1 million." They did, because they had no the structure, none of the administrative background to run a game like that to make the money out of it. So I think that would be a good way of helping the Pacific Islands.
So when I left, we were discussing sevens, so we've obviously moved on. Sorry about that. I had a technical issue, but I'm back now.
Sorry, we moved on to question five, which is the 24 teams in the Rugby World Cup.
Oh, that's good, because I find sevens insufferably tedious, and this is from someone who can sit through 5 days of test cricket, no problems. So, good, let's carry on.
Just to go back to the sevens just very briefly, if you go to the Hong Kong sevens and you enjoy beer, which clearly I do, it's not so much, there is a bunch of guys running around on some green grass down there, but it's much more about the party. And that's what sevens is. A lot of the sevens tournaments are more about the party than they are about necessarily the rugby.
But yeah, anyway. which is what Wellington realised. You know, we've got plenty of bars and pubs. There's no need to hold a rugby tournament
to have a party. It's going to be interesting to see how Hamilton handle it. But no doubt, Mike, you'll be there. But okay, so back to the 24 teams. What do you think? What do you think, Will? Do you think we should have 24 teams at the Rugby World Cup?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a World Cup. There's more than 20 countries in the world. I think if you want to be growing the sport, which we've talked about on this podcast before, then you should be including a few more teams in the World Cup. Now, they're not going to be particularly strong sides, and they're probably going to struggle for a while, but it's going to create almost a second, sort of an unofficial second tier during the pools of these sort of tier two teams playing each other. Which will be immensely valuable for their own development and can be pretty exciting to watch for fans as well. It'll help us to reach, help rugby to reach an even wider global audience. Although I think the Rugby World Cup is the third most watched sporting tournament in the world, isn't it? After the Football World Cup and I'm going to say the Super Bowl, or it might be the IPL.
Or the Olympics, maybe.
Yeah, it's right up there anyway. But So in principle, I'm all for it. I don't really see any obvious downsides from a fan's point of view, at least.
I think the downside that Mike mentioned earlier is the 100 versus nil games, which we might get. Interestingly, when England hosted the Rugby World Cup in 2015, they actually submitted two different proposals. One was for what we got. The other one, I think, was for, I think it was a 16 tournament tier one competition, and then a second tournament, sort of like a Rugby World Plate, happening at the same time for another 8 or 16 teams. I can't remember how many it was now off the top of my head. But that was their way of bringing in more teams, was to have a second tier Rugby World Cup at the same time in the same country. And that way you got more, and you didn't end up with the imbalance. But There is also all the logistical things of how many hotels can you have, how many grounds do you need, and all that sort of side of things.
Those are all solvable problems. You just look at things like the Football World Cup, where there are some more than 20 teams. But I think the idea of having a sort of second tier Rugby World Cup running in parallel, I mean, it gives the sort of weaker teams something to play for, but I think it just reinforces the divide, right? It reinforces the fact that there are supposedly good teams and poor teams.
Can you guys just continue? I've got to go look after the kids. I'll be back in a sec.
No problem. So the point I was just making was, if you were going to have a second tier, then you'd almost want to have some sort of promotion and relegation scheme, surely, where the winner of the second tier automatically qualifies for the first tier World Cup the following time, something like that.
I totally hear what you're saying about, you know, you could reinforce the good teams, bad teams. You know, if we're going to have something like that, you know, maybe have these games as like curtain raisers for, you know, for the main event, as it were. So
just seems like it's very, very difficult for these weaker teams to sort of advance. You know, if they've got no hope of playing in the World Cup, then having 24 spots available instead of 20 would give them a bit of an incentive to actually improve. And I think there's a comment here, a couple of comments here on Twitter, just saying, no, don't expand it, mainly for the same reasons by the looks of it, too much of a gap between the top and the bottom teams. But another aspect that's been brought up again by Hugh is it would make the tournament too long.
Yep.
But we're really only talking about adding one more pool in, right? So we're not talking about adding a whole bunch of games. I don't think it would actually add that much time to the tournament itself.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people would. Well, there's always the majority, the small minority, but I these tournaments, for my mind, are too quick anyway. So add another week or two at the max on top of it.
I mean, I guess you've still got to come up with a format that gives you, 8 finalists or whatever, 16 finalists, however you're going to do it. So you could be adding more matches into the knockout stages. But that is not necessarily a bad thing either. And it would certainly, if you could spread the teams out across an additional pool, you might not have these pools of death that seem to crop up every year where some really quality teams miss out simply because there's not room for 3 to qualify from a particular pool.
I think there are two ways of expanding it. One is to make each pool have one more team. Which is, I think, how we go to the 24, because we have 20 currently. So you're not adding an extra pool, because that would be an extra 5 teams, not 4 teams. So I think, yeah, the idea is to add an extra, and that would be an extra week. Now, the problem with that is they're already struggling to find enough time for the window of the Rugby World Cup, and therefore that's why we have the disparity in some of the Tier 2 teams having to play 3 games in around about 7 to 10 days. Which is much more onerous than playing, than having having a game every 7 days, which the Tier 1 teams had. I actually did an article about that, about whether how fair the Rugby World Cup draw was, and it definitely wasn't on some sides. Japan, for example, I think could have qualified for, we're in it with a shout anyway, of qualifying for the knockouts, but because they faced Scotland, something like, it was like 3 days after facing South Africa, there was no way they could put out their first strength team. And the Tier 2 teams just don't have the strength in depth to compete at that level and rotate all their players.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It was a bit anticlimactic when they fell to Scotland after that spectacular win over South Africa. Although that's kind of a good example of what can happen, right? It's infrequent, but there's certainly David and Goliath battles that have occurred where David has won. And I think giving a few more teams the opportunity to even have a go at that, we'll probably see a few more. I think it's a bit of a clash between the practical reality, right? It's always the case with these things. There's sort of an aspirational ideal where you say, well, obviously we'd like to have many strong teams participating in this tournament. It would include more countries and there'd be more matches for the fans to watch, and the whole tournament would be bigger and more awesome. But then there's the sort of real world, like you say, where there's all the logistics and the planning and the actual teams themselves having the money and the players, which kind of squash all of that, and you end up keeping on doing what you've always done, which is 20 teams in recent years.
Richard Palmer makes a good point on Twitter. I think they need to sort out better competition for the Minnows in between World Cup years before they do that. And that's, I guess that's part of what I was talking about the pre-season games to the Pacific Islands. Actually, I think a topic for another week, and I'm thinking about it now, is how does a Tier 2 team become a Tier 1 team? Because at the moment, the only way of doing that is to get into either the Six Nations or the Rugby Championship, which are both closed shops. So for those of you who are watching or listening, come back in a couple of weeks, and that's, I think that'll be one of our topics that we'll be talking about. We're kind of running out of time now, so it's predictions times, my friends. And there is only one game to predict for this weekend, and that is the Lions versus the Crusaders. So, Will, what does your algorithm say?
Yeah, well, so my algorithm's done pretty well. It's 6 from 6 from the playoffs, and in the regular season, it was about 80% correct. So I ran the numbers last night. I haven't published them yet, but I'm going to have to back my algorithm. It's picking the Lions, and I'm going to go not by much. I'm going to say Lions by 5.
So can you can we have a sneak preview as to what the percentages were?
Yeah. It came out at 66% probability of a Lions victory. The way it works, just to explain to those listeners who haven't encountered what I do before, it calculates the offensive and the defensive strength of each team based on their recent form and their performance over the season. And then it uses that to predict which team's going to win a given match based on how teams of similar ratings have had their results fall in the past. And this week, there's almost nothing separating the Lions and the Crusaders in terms of their offensive and defensive ratings. I was quite surprised. The Crusaders are slightly better at both, but they're very, very close together. And I'll see if I can put a chart up underneath the question, perhaps, on Twitter, so you can see what I'm talking about. But anyway, the short version of that is, because my model thinks they're roughly equivalent in strength, the Crusaders are slightly better, it's home field advantage that's tipping the balance in favour of the Lions. That, historically, home teams win much more than away teams.
So, Mike, do you agree with the algorithm, or is your heart going to take you somewhere else?
Oh, it's hard to argue with numbers, but from the start of the season, I've predicted that the Crusaders, it was going to be their year, and I'm still going to go with that, you know, because, like, this team, it's defensively sound, probably the most clinical inside that red zone. The Lions are going to put up much more of a fight than I think any of us predicted. I think a lot of us actually didn't think they'd even make the final, but despite all that, despite the ref being South African, don't even get me started on that, I think the Crusaders, purely because I predicted it from the start of the season.
And what's your winning margin going to be?
Oh, it'll be close. 5 or under, Crusaders.
Cool. FYB or Rugby on Twitter reminds me, it's going to be a cracker because it's got a 62,000 sellout. It's a sold-out game already, so that's going to be definitely the biggest crowd of Super Rugby for this season, where we've seen some really poor crowds. So it's great to see a full stadium for the final. Going with Lions by 7. I had an interview earlier today, and basically it's down to they've been to a final recently, they've got home advantage, they aren't having to travel, and they're at altitude. So it's those sort of things that I think will sway it. If it was in Christchurch, I would probably go the other way. So I'm going Lions by 7. So thank you, everybody, for listening. If you, don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel if you've been watching on YouTube, and to your podcast player if you're listening to the recording. Will, why don't you let people know where they can find you?
Yeah, so when I'm not on Rugby Chat, you can find me on rugbynumbers.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at rugbynumbers, and then you'll get to read all about how the model works and how it's been going. And if you can, you can go back and look at my pre-season forecast, which had picked the Lions as favourites for the title before the season had even begun. So I guess I have to wait till this weekend to find out whether that was correct or not.
Well, Nostradamus. And Mike, where can people get hold of you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at RealMikePullman. And I go to lastwordonrugby.com. One of the editors there write quite regular content, got a story. Opinion piece coming out on Yoko Piper, hopefully, if the editor of the management that be allow me to run such a opinionated piece. And yeah.
And I'm sure it'll be measured and polite, Mike. Nothing else.
Yeah.
Please, obviously, I'm driving more. I'm Paul the guy behind Driving Mall. I do daily videos on YouTube and on Twitter. So Driving Mall on both of those channels. So catch me there. Next week, we will be doing our Super Rugby season review, and we'll be giving every team a grade out of A, B, C or D as to how they have done. We'll be quicker over some of the teams than the others. Yeah, meters for that. Obviously, we'll have those RPI index from Rugby Numbers as to how he thought they were going to do at the beginning of the season. And it'll be interesting to compare how they've done compared to who has overperformed and who has underperformed over the season. But as I say,
don't forget, some good ones for you, Paul.
Oh, don't forget to subscribe. So make sure that lands on your phone next week. Thank you very much for joining us. And as I say, use #RugbyChat. We're always up for a good old chat.